I'm retooling kind of everything I do right now, software-wise.
Tell me what that means.
I don't really know why I'm doing it, except that I imagine that I must be feeling restless or tired of the way things were working before. And I think that the first salvo in my war against the status quo was buying two Echo devices to see how those would fit into our life. And in a rare display of self-control, I think I realized very quickly that they didn't fit, and I returned them. Of course, in a very common, typical show of complete lack of self-control, I then replaced it with a HomePod. But that didn't actually change really how I do anything. That's the interesting part, is that I realized from the whole Echo experience that having a hands-free interface and a speaker in the kitchen was something that I wanted, but that was all I really wanted to add to my life. I didn't want a whole nother ecosystem of stuff. HomePod and Siri stuff, I'm sure we'll talk about at some point, but really that didn't change very much. It was just a new way of interacting with the stuff I'm already using. That momentum carried into this whole review of everything that I'm using, like every personal technology that I use. I mean, reading is the stuff that took the brunt of this effort.
Yeah.
But as I've talked about online many times, like that's the most important activity for me. And I ripped out the floorboards of how I get my RSS. And I have some regrets about being so hasty with that. I'm not sure that the new solution I've chosen is that good of a solution. And I got a Kindle for the first time in, oh man, I don't know, 5 years.
What made you do that? Like everything else so far that you've said is pretty, I don't really have a great solution for having a device in my house that I can talk to and play music. I get that.
Yeah.
And RSS has been slightly unsatisfying. This solution's been great because it's working, but this one seems kind of interesting and it might work in different ways. Like, I get that. But the Kindle thing is so strange to me because you're so far into iBooks, and I've never really heard you talk about being frustrated with your reading experience, and going into Amazon's ecosystem whole hog is like, I feel like it's a big deal.
Well, it would be if Amazon's ecosystem worked the way that I feel a personal media library should work, which of course it doesn't.
No, it does not.
As I'm sure we've talked about, I've been craving a non-backlit e-ink device for reading books on for a long time. And that compromise to read on an iPad or on my phone seemed worth it at the beginning, given how much closer to my ideal iBooks is as a way of managing my media library, and it still is.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that I still intend to use it as my media library for books in terms of long-term storage. But I got so tired of reading on an iPad because it's heavy and too large and backlit, and so it's hard on the eyes, and it's full of distractions.
Yeah.
So I noticed that I wasn't reading books. I was just buying them and not reading them because books got way easier to buy and way easier to store. And that's about all that has changed. I mean, I have read a lot of books and iBooks in the last few years, but it's dried up. I've gotten too distractible. And so I've been wanting an e-ink screen to read on for a long time, a single purpose device. And I was holding out. There's a company called Remarkable that is making, their goal seems to be to compete with paper with these really high resolution, beautiful displays. But their first device is way too large and way too expensive. And I want a Kindle sized one. And that hasn't come. And then, as is bound to happen, I was on Amazon last week, and they offered me $60 off a Kindle Paperwhite, which is more than half the price of it.
Yeah.
So I went for it. And on the one hand, I have the device that I wanted. Like, now I can read a book without being distracted. An ebook, that is. Of course, paper books are a far better interface than even a Kindle.
And they still work.
They still work just fine and will still work forever. And I own the book. I'm not just like on temporary like loan for as long as the a particular for-profit company's system exists.
R.I.P. Nook. R.I.P. all my books in the Nook library.
Right. So the thing is, you can crack the DRM on Kindle books. So I still very much intend to throw every book I buy from Amazon
into iBooks
and keep it forever that way.
Which you can do. You can do that really well now because of the iCloud thing, right?
Yeah.
Because I remember throwing books into iBooks years ago, and then when I got a new phone, all those books were gone and my highlights. But with iCloud, whenever you stick something in there, it's there and your highlights are there. No matter if you grab a new phone or an iPad or anything else,
your
books are going to sync. That's great.
That's why I love it.
Yeah, that's really amazing.
And all open format eBooks work in there. And PDFs work. You know, you can download a whole book in PDF and it'll sync your pages across your devices. iBooks is the best. The only thing that it doesn't have is the right display for me to have the experience that I want. Mm-hmm. So here I am compromising with this Kindle, which while it does have a great screen, the typography is the same terrible typography that it had 5 years ago with only justified text and one font. And the one downside to Apple's ebook environment is that apparently the DRM on their books has not been cracked or isn't anywhere near as easy to crack as Amazon's is.
Yeah.
So while I can buy Kindle books and throw them into iBooks for safekeeping, I cannot read the 25 books I've bought on iBooks and haven't read yet on my Kindle.
Yeah.
So I'm in this ridiculous situation that no one else would be in because a normal person who wanted to read ebooks knows that the Kindle is the way to do that and they would have their books in Kindle forever. And I'm trying this ridiculous iCloud-based RSS reader that doesn't have a service behind it. And I hastily canceled the service that I loved that I was using for RSS because I thought this was the future. And now it's janky and iCloud-based. And I'm saving like $10 a year. That's the thing I said, oh, nice. Now I don't have to pay $10 a year anymore. And then at some point, this was definitely something I only did because I got a HomePod. But you and I have both griped about Overcast's interface a lot lately. And I just dealt with it because nothing else seemed to be designed, you know, around a healthy habit of podcast listening.
Mm.
Everything worked the way I wanted it to. Like, I had the ability to do everything I wanted to do in Overcast. It just wasn't that pleasurable of an experience. And lately, I've been finding it having sync problems and stuff that just was annoying, losing my playback position, stuff that I didn't want to deal with. And so I felt vulnerable to a new opportunity in podcasts. And then I got a HomePod and realized that if I use the Apple Podcasts app, I would be able to play my shows in the kitchen without AirPlay, which is not a huge difference, but that is the thing I'm doing, listening to podcasts in the kitchen every weekday when I'm making lunch.
Right.
That has got me thinking about the whole kitchen speaker thing in the first place. So I decided to download Apple's podcast app for the first time. As soon as you could remove stock apps from your phone, I removed it. And so I added it back and I moved my subscriptions over. I'm actually quite satisfied with the podcast app.
It's come a long way.
Yeah, it really has come a long way. It has some features that nobody else has, some of which are the advantage of having the de facto podcast directory of the world as your own media ecosystem.
Right.
So the reviews are all built in and the discovery of new shows is incredibly good.
Yeah. The recommendations in podcast app is wild. I thought that it was pretty good in Overcast, but it's recommending me shows that I'd never heard of that are very good and very popular.
Yep.
Like, that's the fun thing about podcasts, right? Is it's so huge that you can go for quite a while being in your own bubble and miss out on a show or two, but because podcasts app
right.
knows everything about every podcast.
Since the beginning of podcasts.
Yeah, they can send me some recommendations.
One of the coolest things I've found about it is that it'll dig up a show that's 5 years old that ended. That wouldn't be that cool if it weren't also so well targeted in terms of topic.
Right.
That I've ended up listening to some really old episodes of various things. The creaky iTunes infrastructure behind it is visible in certain ways, but I'm happy with that move. The reason we're talking about this, the reason why I brought this up, is just because I realized that once again, I'm in the midst of just like completely like renovating my house.
Yeah.
And as someone who loves this stuff and cares about this stuff, by which I mean digital media and software and hardware like surrounding me all the time, I put up with a lot of chaos and frustration. And I was thinking about that as I was in the midst of it, and thinking about the fact that that seems like a paradox to me, because people who live in the midst of like a constantly renovated house are also the people that other people ask about their own digital lives and how to renovate their own houses and what devices to buy and what software to use. And I realize that there's a contradiction there, like a paradox or a mystery, because really, if you ask me that right now, my answer would be, I have no idea. None of it works. You know, yeah. Like, why would you listen to me? Why would you bring this upon yourself? I just crave simplicity so badly now that, like, I would recommend, I don't know, just don't read ebooks. Just don't do it. Just buy books and go to the library.
Yeah, that's actually probably the best recommendation you can possibly make at this point for the books in particular.
Yes, exactly. So I just thought about like this whole thing about like what computer should I buy as like a conversation that family members get you into all the time. And like it's just such a deeper rabbit hole than that.
The question is getting more scattershot, right? Because years ago, if people were asking those kinds of questions, the answers were fairly simple. The question was, what kind of phone should I have?
Right.
And the answer would be an iPhone in almost every circumstance.
Yeah.
Or what kind of computer should I have? And it was, well, depending on who you are, a MacBook Air or a MacBook Pro. But then as time has gone on, now there are so many different questions, because this is the pervasive way that technology is continuing to integrate itself into so many parts of our lives. Because now you have to have, well, you don't have to have, but it feels like you have to have a computer and a tablet and a phone and a home speaker and a smart lock and smart lights and
watch.
As these people are constantly trying to get users into their ecosystems, the questions get all the more challenging, because who's to say what's better over a Sonos or a HomePod? And if someone asked me if they should buy a Sonos or a HomePod or a Echo, I would have a list of like 15 to 20 questions that I'd need to ask them before I could determine the answer to that, I feel like.
Yep.
Whereas before, there was no such requirement. I don't think that I'd recommend anyone go out and buy the latest Acer laptop. I think I still have a solid answer to that. But at the same time, if someone said, should I get the MacBook Pro with a touch bar? Like, I don't know if I could give that a ringing endorsement. Mm. And not necessarily for the reasons that other people criticize it, but like we've talked about, it's my least favorite computer I've ever owned. So I'm not feeling super happy about the concept of telling people to go out and buy that. And it used to be, oh, well, let's check the month and see whether you should buy the iPhone right now or the next iPhone that comes out in a few short months. But now it's, well, should they buy the iPhone? Wait, what even is it? 8?
Yeah, that's my phone.
Yeah, the iPhone 8 or the iPhone 8 Plus or the iPhone 10, or should they wait?
Or buy an iPhone 7, which is still a fantastic phone.
Yes, exactly. Or stick with the thing that they had before. And this actually happened to me not that long ago. Somebody was kind of spinning up an art business. They said, oh, I can totally upgrade my phone right now, and I want to, because I want to take good photos of my art.
Yeah.
So I can sell it.
Yeah.
And they said, which one should I get? And that was right before the iPhone 10 came out. And they said, should I get the 7 or the 7 Plus? And I felt like kind of at a loss of what to tell them, because it was sort of like, well, if you really need it right now, I guess get the Plus. But I don't think that you would actually want the Plus for anything other than the fact that the camera's slightly better. And then you could maybe get the 7 because the camera's better than the one that you have. But then you could also, you know, like that's kind of how I feel with basically every question now, is I have to juggle all of these prerequisites and conditions before I can recommend something to somebody.
Yeah.
And that feels kind of strange. And it's definitely not going to get simpler as these ecosystems get stronger, right?
Yeah. Well, there's at least two layers to the ecosystem problem. The lower level layer for us, I think, which is the one that you were just digging into, is that Apple's product lines are a complete disaster right now. And so days of the matrix, of the 2x2 matrix of Macs, that was like
the pros and the non-pros, MacBook and iMac and MacBook Pro and Mac Pro. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There, it was an easy decision. And now that those days are way gone. The Mac is a mess. The iPad is a mess. The phones are a mess too, which is crazy, because iPhone, it was like the stalwart, like singular concept through the crazy years of the Android Cambrian explosion of different specs and sizes and everything. Like iPhone was iPhone. Even now there's like, and you know, now iPhone is totally subject to that.
I mean, the fact that you and I have different iPhones is wild.
Yeah, that's nuts. That never would have happened.
Yeah, that would have never, ever happened.
That's one level. But I think that the surrounding problem to that of just how the ecosystems interoperate and what the entry points are, I think that's where the inquiry has to start. If somebody wants to know what to do, what to use, what to do next, you have to start by figuring out what ecosystems they're already absorbed in. And that is confused by every ecosystem story is so different about what layer software and services are and what layer the hardware is, that it's getting harder and harder to plug them into each other, at least conceptually. And I just had the conversation with my parents of like, hey, mom and dad, I just got an Echo. They're like, oh, what's that? I explained it to them. They sounded very interested. I was like, you should totally get one. I was giving them advice on an ecosystem that I don't fully understand, that I had just exposed myself to really for the first time. And a week later, I'd already traded it in.
Completely removed yourself from.
Yeah.
Until you bought the Kindle and brought yourself
right,
back.
Exactly. In. To a different part of it that's like not related. I mean, it's just as confusing to me as it was to them, is the thing that I was discovering. But the really weird thing is that I feel like I gave them the right advice. I feel like that was the right home speaker thing for them to get, because they are just like slightly tipped a little bit further over into the Amazon world than I am, even though they have iPhones and iPads and Macs. So like it completely changes the equation. And not to get all zen about it, but like I really think that you have to zoom way out in this conversation now. It was taken for granted 5 years ago that one should have a phone. So the conversation, what phone should I get, was a simple matter of how good of a phone do you need to have.
Right.
Now it's a much more philosophical question. It's like, well, what do you need to do? The problem is a lot of people haven't thought about that or haven't completed the inventory of that, or they think about one problem at a time. Oh, I want to watch March Madness on my phone or whatever. There's like one thing they can't figure out how to do that they need to do right now. And because of the world that we're in with all these ecosystems trying to lock you in, like companies will sell you something that will have many years of ramifications just so you can watch your basketball game or your shows. Mm. And we get ourselves into these situations where we're all tied up in knots, like about which RSS reader to use, because we know what the things are that we want to get done. And finding the best solution to the whole matrix of problems is the way that we go about it. But you can't assume that level of understanding of the problem when somebody comes to you and says, you know a lot about phones. Which one should I get? And the answer, like, get the one I have, is so obnoxious.
Yeah, that's not great. I feel that slightly, in the sense that I'm not going to recommend an Android device. I'm going to recommend an iOS device. I recommend Apple devices because I'm pretty confident that that's the answer that most people are looking for when they don't know what they're looking for. But it's when we get into these more fringe pieces of technology that I get totally confused myself. And once you bought the HomePod, we've had some conversations back and forth about how I bought into the Sonos system for a few different reasons, and I've been really happy with that, partially because we all listen to Spotify, and Spotify and HomePod don't really seem to get along very well. But once you bought the HomePod, it started making me second guess my own decision there. And man, I should have bought the HomePod. That seems pretty cool. And using Siri and that kind of stuff. Last night, Christine and I were watching a television program with two Sonos speakers on full blast as we like cooked and cleaned and stuff. And that was awesome. So it reinvigorated my love of the Sonos system. But yeah, I mean, this is the thing, right? Is even me, the guy who spends a bunch of time researching everything, is confused if I made the right decision. And perhaps not even me, especially me, because I'm sure that there are people who bought an Amazon Echo on Black Friday sale and have never even once second-guessed that decision.
Or even think the speaker sucks.
Yeah, they're not thinking about that. They're just enjoying it and couldn't care less about the HomePod or the Sonos One or the Google Play Max or whatever that one's called.
Well, the one thing I've learned since getting a HomePod in the house is that the differences between these things are exaggerated by the media that we surround ourselves with. There were more HomePod reviews than I can remember a product getting in a long time. I think it was because of this. I think it was because everybody knew, even though many people didn't want to admit, that the HomePod did not have the features that the other competitor speaker tubes had. So Apple was positioning it as, well, ours is the best sounding speaker and it also has Siri. And so everybody who wanted to love it so much bit that hook that Apple laid out and said, yeah, sound quality, that's what I care about. Here's my review of the sound quality of the HomePod. And I'm a real audiophile and I have gold plated cables on everything. And I think the HomePod is the best sounding speaker I've ever heard in my life.
Yes, I had an Echo 6 months ago. Don't worry about it.
Exactly. Here's my review of the HomePod speaker. The HomePod speaker is a really good single speaker in a corner of a room of a house.
Wow.
It sounds very nice indeed. It sounds better than the Echo speaker did. It's not going to change my life. And when I put music on in the living room on the 5.1 system plugged into the Apple TV, it sounds way better. So, you know, like it's not like the speaker in the corner in the kitchen is going to revolutionize my music listening experience. It's just like a nice sounding thing that I have.
Or your podcasts that are recorded at like low fidelity to begin with.
Exactly. And published in mono. My point is, it's not a huge deal. I'm sure that multiple Sonos speakers would delight me to no end in a way that the HomePod can't until it gets the mythical software update that it was supposed to ship with, where you can play them through more than one speaker at a time, which of course I'm not going to have because, I mean, I bought one, but I'm not going to buy two, let alone put them in the same room. Like, that's very weird idea. The reason why I'm happier with this thing than I was with the Echo is very slight. It's just that I use Siri all the time.
Right.
Because I have it on my wrist. And so now I can use it in that room when I'm washing dishes, when I don't have my watch on because I'm washing the dishes. Because I'm used to the syntax, like I do ask it to play music and I know what I have available because I'm an Apple Music subscriber. Like you said, Spotify, it's not a first-class citizen of the HomePod. But Arielle does use Spotify because she's on a family plan with a friend and she can AirPlay over to it. So it's like not the end of the world. It's a compromise is the point. It's a compromise between the ecosystems that I as the 95% of the time user of the HomePod use and the ones that the other 5% user of the HomePod uses. So it's not a perfect answer and there wouldn't really be one, I don't think. And your way of using Sonos is a very fine answer for what you need to do. And the fact that it's the same thing that you and I are trying to do, I mean, we just have to settle for whatever works.
Here's what I end up doing. And really the only thing that I try to make a major consideration when I'm talking to people about technology these days is I really want to try and figure out how to reduce friction for whatever the person does the most.
Yeah.
Because I feel like friction is the thing that actually makes me the most frustrated these days. And it is one of those unfortunate realities that as things get more complex, there has been more friction.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you see like a science fiction movie, everything's so seamless and perfect. And I think of like Her by Spike Jones. And, you know, there's this little computer in your pocket and does all these things. And the assistant is perfect. And he's checking his email via audio. And it's, you know, all going so incredibly. And it's just like that's what the future is supposed to be like. But in my experience, the future has just introduced more friction between me and the thing that I'm trying to get done. And I don't blame the people who are making the technology for that because these things are getting insanely complicated. So, of course, it's introducing new things and different use cases. And of course, not everyone is doing the exact same thing in the exact same way. I get it. But that is the thing that frustrates me to no end is the weird pieces of friction that stop me from enjoying my time. And even like the Sonos is an example of that. I've noticed that sometimes Christine will ask me to play a song, even though she has her phone and could play it just as easily, because you have to open the Sonos app and browse through your music. And there's a few steps there. And if one of those steps is confusing, then you're probably not going to use it.
Yep.
So the only thing that I can recommend to people is whatever I think they'll actually use more than the other thing. And that's really all that really matters, I guess, at this point. So, for example, that person that asked me what phone to buy, I think I kind of waffled and gave like a non-answer because honestly, it didn't matter because they were just going to buy an iPhone and the iPhones were all fairly the same as far as taking a picture goes.
Right.
And they were all fine. And I'm sure that whichever one she bought was fine. But I would not have wanted her to get a phone that made picture taking more complicated. Mm-hmm. The only thing that I can recommend people towards is stuff that I think is going to reduce friction. And for to go back to the speaker thing, that is often the Echo, because everyone is comfortable with the Echo. And I've seen so many people that don't have a lot of technological experience having a great time asking their Echo to spin up a song or set a timer or whatever. And the friction is pretty minimal. So, hey, go buy your $50 dot and hook it up to a speaker and ask it some stuff, and you'll be satisfied with that. Don't go buy the $300 plus HomePod that you're not going to know how to use and might return because it frustrates you and you're going to be sad about how much money you spent on it. Yeah, you know, just like one of those weird things where it's challenging to try to figure out what the frictionless thing is for people.
Yeah, and how much unnecessary friction we introduce by doing too much or trying to do the same thing everywhere.
Yeah.
I think that one of the reasons I went for the Kindle at this time in my life was because I miss the days of single purpose things.
Right.
I got overwhelmed by the idea that my phone, my iPad, and my Mac are all capable of doing all of the things that I do. And it's like I have to choose which one to do it on. The thing that seemed like convenience at the beginning of that, where I realized, oh, I can just use whichever one I have in my hands at the moment,
yeah,
became a series of difficult questions about which thing would be the best at this or the most enjoyable to use. And that's a very digital problem. So it becomes a kind of friction of choices to make, even if the design of the system appears to have less friction because you don't have to go into the other room to do something anymore. But there's a little bit of friction in every choice about which experience to have right now of the same one thing you're just trying to get done.
I haven't really considered the whole paradox of choice concept for a while, but I think that is a real thing. To me, the problem that you introduced is the fact that now you have another device on which to read, not narrowing it down. But maybe you're different than I am. I know that that's kind of how I felt when I had a Kindle, is, geez, now do I pick up the book on my phone or on my tablet or my Kindle, like depending on where I was or what I wanted to do. But maybe you have some more self-control than I do.
Yeah, once I start buying books from the Kindle store, it will be on all my devices. That's true. But it's always an easy decision for me to pick up the Kindle. I think the paradox of choice there is solved by once I choose to read on the Kindle, I will have no choice but to continue reading the book on the Kindle instead of having to, every time I pause my reading, make a choice of whether to continue reading or go read something else in some other app or something,
yeah,
which is what I was doing before.
Right.
So I definitely think of the Kindle as something that will restrict my choices by imposing meaningful constraints around the thing I'm actually trying to do. There's no denying the value of that, but that's not to say that I wouldn't read on the iPad if the experience were vastly better.
As you were talking about that, the thing that came to my mind for some reason was the fact that it made me remember when I had just a MacBook, like before phones were a real thing. I remember reading books on that thing. I remember reading comics on it. I remember flipping the screen sideways and reading comics on it. Like,
wow.
You know, that's ludicrous to me to think of now, but it made total sense when I only had one device. And I wonder if I did more with it than I do with all of my stuff combined now, because I never spent time questioning if I was doing the right thing at that right moment or not. I just knew that's what I had and what I could do, and by gosh, I did it. I don't know. It's a really funny concept to think about that.
I think that speaks of you as a future iPad user more than anything else. But
yeah, it's true.
But I totally relate to that period of time the same way. Like, I cared about my Mac so much then and really learned everything that I know about how to make my tools work for me on one single device, and then exploding it out into more devices has almost felt like it has more downsides than upsides, except for portability.
Mm.
That's why I think I look forward to getting rid of the desktop PC paradigm now, as crazy as that is for me to say. Now it creates more decisions and doesn't really solve more problems. And the number of things I have to use it for, I can count on one hand. The thing that's awkward about this phase is that we see that we're moving into a world where we can interact with the same applications on small and large screens. And that the iOS world has fully brought us into that reality where we really are literally using the same app on two devices in two different form factors. And the watch is starting to add a third that's a micro version that interacts beautifully with both. But we're still in the awkward transition phase where there are multiple $1,000 pieces of glass that are of a fixed size and shape that are mediating those shared experiences so that we can't think of it all as being in one place that we just go to do our thing.
No way.
Because it's frozen into these crystalline objects of desire that are limited. As powerful as they are, the iPad is the size that it is, so I can't do the thing I want to do on my 27-inch display on it. The hope that we've talked about is like leapfrogging that someday into a world where it's just all the software is just projected around us. And then that does simplify the conversations that we have with people about how to like live in a high-tech environment, because you don't have to think so hard about where to project these experiences.
And that thinking really crushes me sometimes. Mm. I think the biggest example of that is photography, mm-hmm. where I felt for the last like year so weird about taking photos because it's been such a challenge to figure out how to do it once I take the photo. Because I do very minor editing to my photos, but it's always a good idea to, you know, adjust it slightly.
Sure.
And figuring out how to do that is so hard. If I shoot with a DSLR, then I have to import the photos, and I can use the official camera app on the iPhone or the iPad, but it's really slow, and I have to do this weird Wi-Fi connect. Or I can use the SD card importer, but then once I import the photos to my iPhone or my iPad, where am I going to put it? If I put it on the iPad, I get a bigger screen. If I put it on my iPhone, I have access to Instagram instantly. And then where do I edit it? Do I edit it in Visco? Do I edit it in Lightroom? Do I edit it in Darkroom? If I try to put it in Lightroom, the features are different on the iPhone and the iPad and the Mac. Mm. And if I want to adjust geometry because like a building is crooked, I can only do that in Lightroom for the Mac. I cannot do it on iOS yet. And if I want to do other features, they're only on the iPhone and iPad and not on the Mac. And it just is really weird how many complex answers I have to respond to when I just want to edit the pretty sunset that I took. Mm-hmm. And it makes me not want to pick up my camera and even actually taking the photo because I have this great iPhone 10 camera in my hand and I rarely use it because I know I have a better camera in my backpack or at home.
Yeah.
And I think, I could take a really good photo, but it would be a better photo if I pulled out my actual camera. And that means that I don't take a photo at all. And it's just like weird stuff like that, where because I have choice, I end up doing nothing. And I want to get around that. And I know that part of that is on me. Like the software and the hardware is not the thing that is stopping me from taking the photo. It is me that is stopping me from taking the photo. But it sure isn't helping.
The model suggested by the way that Apple's Photos app works extended into the future, I think presents a much simpler workflow for all of that than the one that you're describing. You make a really important point, which is that the more technical and professional grade a problem is, the harder it is to have that shared experience across platforms or devices.
Yeah.
And the case that I was thinking of when I was talking about shared software experiences across devices was much more of the like checking email variety.
Right.
But because Apple is the company that believes so much in client-side software and like local apps running on your device doing stuff, they're pushing this extension model where apps reach into other apps to provide their one essential service inside of those apps. Photos is one of them. And the dream of professional grade photo extensions where you can use, you know, whatever your editing tools of choice are inside of Apple's Photos app, we're not there yet. You can imagine, you know, if we get to that future beautiful Minority Report, whatever world that we're dreaming of, it takes away an interface question for every single component of this. Because the photo is a thing now.
Right.
So the dream to me for a photographer would be you use your camera, your real good camera, you take a picture, it goes onto your device immediately, whatever, like on your watch, let's say. And then when you want to work on it, you touch it and then bring it into the world with you so that it's there in front of you. And then the tools to edit it are inserted into that interface through some model of extensions. And you can get new ones that are more professional if that's what you need. But the idea of the photo being there is simplified dramatically because it's not the photo on this display with true tone color profiles. You know, I don't know anything about photos or color, obviously, but like you don't have to worry about how each device is going to understand these changes. You got a photo that's a thing that's there, and then working on it is like working on a physical object.
Right.
But we're so far from this that it's like heartbreaking to talk about.
It is. Yes, it really is. And, you know, extensions to Photos app on the iPhone came several iOS versions ago, and I was very excited about that. And it sort of died on the vine. There's not a lot going on there, which, again, could be built out more at any moment. But, it made me excited, and my excitement quickly died as I realized that I was never going to use this in its current form.
Yeah, I think WWDC 2018 is going to bring the whole platform forward in a way that needed to happen before Apple put any of these ideas into our heads.
It's probably a good idea, yeah.
I hope that it's going to simplify things. It's going to make the recommendations of hardware and software alike simpler. What I'm referring to is a pretty widely believed rumor that some kind of underlying framework for Mac and iOS software is going to be announced that will make it possible for the same application to run, at least in some form, on both platforms.
Yeah.
I think what we're going to get this year is a much more fundamental statement of the value of that approach, where writing an application is going to be something you do fundamentally one time. And as many advanced ramifications as that's going to have for developers and for prosumers like us, I have hope that it's going to simplify the platform too. It's going to make it much closer to a decision of just like, well, do you want a laptop with a keyboard, or do you want a thing you can tear off and carry around in one hand? You know, like, it's going to just make it a much more realistic assessment rather than, does this app that you like have an iOS version, or all of these really confusing intermediate steps between what do you want to do with it and how are you going to do it?
Do you think that in the next few years, we're going to see the recommendations get easier again? Or do you think that we're stuck with some pretty complex answers for the future?
How it feels right now to me is that it's harder to know what 2 years from now is going to be like than it is to know what 10 years from now is going to be like.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
I think that's a very weird place to be, and I haven't felt that way yet. As much as I've been immersed in the play-by-play of this whole Silicon Valley world, for most of that time, it has felt like these things we have are going to continue iterating and competing with each other for the time being, and who knows what's going to happen next. And it feels like a fundamental shift has happened. I see where we're going, but how in the world are we going to get there? One embryonic version of this question people have stopped saying, which is, when is Apple going to invent the next big thing? Like, I'm bored of iPhones. Like, every iPhone is the same, is what they used to say. And we all used to say, you're insane.
Yeah.
But they don't say that anymore, because I think Apple has succeeded, despite a lot of detractors harping on this strategy, at exploding the idea that the next thing, the next quote unquote big thing, is going to be, you know, like a band dropping a new hit record. It's not going to be a new I thing is going to come out and they're going to have like a curtain, pull back the curtain and reveal a new thing.
Right.
They're releasing little pieces that go all over your body and all over your house and car and explode the very idea that like one mythical device is going to be the new paradigm.
The AirPods and the HomePod and the iPad and everything else, they're all incremental change that's taking over a piece of you.
And people said the watch was going to be one of those accessories, but now I think people get like the market is bearing out the fact that this is a new version of what the iPhone offered.
Right.
A new and radically more personal and embodied way of thinking about what the middle of your computer life is. But it's less significant, not more. That's the thing. So
yeah,
that I think has paved the way So people don't say, what's the next iPhone going to be anymore? They get that like little personal choices are going to determine what your computing life looks like. But, you know, not to just talk about Apple, they're having a lot of trouble shipping things right now. It must be increasing the complexity of delivering the future in unimaginable ways. And we can imagine a lot of ways in which it's getting more complex. That's what we've been talking about the whole time, is like how much more complex the user experience is. We can only imagine in the faintest way, like how much more complex it must be to engineer systems to connect all of these things.
I think part of the complexity too comes from the fact that nothing really dies the way that it used to or wins the way that it used to. Like I think of HD DVD and Blu-ray, right? You know, two huge competing things that come out, and people rooted for both systems for a while, and then it became exceedingly clear pretty quickly that one won and one did not.
Right.
But no one's saying, is the HomePod the Echo killer? Because it's not, and it couldn't be, and it won't be, and nothing really kills anything else the way that it used to. I mean, we could say maybe the Apple Watch is an interesting example where there were a bunch of watches, and then the Apple Watch came out, and then there weren't those other watches. And now there's another kind of watch that is more focused around competing with the Apple Watch or fitness bands or whatever you wanted to call the pre-Apple Watch things. But nothing really dies. I can't really think of anything huge except for the very obvious examples like the Apple Newton.
We had some at school. They were so weird.
That's an example of an Apple product that was a failure and was killed. But I mean, how long has it been since an Apple product died because it was unsuccessful, right? I mean,
there are products that they have effectively killed that they still sell for unbelievable amounts of money.
Like what?
You know, like the Mac Mini and the Mac Pro and the AirPort.
Yeah, but they're part of an ecosystem that has a bigger thing going on. You know, that was one piece of hardware with other pieces of hardware, and the other pieces of hardware that did the same thing were more successful. It's not like next year they're going to say, wow, you know, the Echo really ate our lunch and the Sonos really, really crushed it. You know, HomePod is no more. Like, that's not going to happen.
Self-cannibalizing doesn't count in quite the same. I mean, like, they killed the iPod Classic, but that's because who wants an iPod Classic now?
Right, but that's because it still lives.
Right.
Yeah, because, you know, it's now Apple Music. It still exists in a different form. The big companies, the Amazons and the Apples and the Googles and the Microsofts. And maybe Microsoft is the only example that, you know, is the exception here, where they are going through huge restructurings and they are killing things off and all of that. But these companies, they're not building things that are these moonshots that may work or may not. The last example I can think of is Google Glass, which was an obvious way too soon and way too bad thing to ship. Things just aren't flops the way that they used to be. And because of that, the world has gotten much more complex. No one's winning and no one's losing.
I'm still thinking of counterexamples, but like, I agree that Microsoft is kind of a weird... Ben Thompson released a really great post called The End of Windows, summarizing the whole reorganization in the last couple of weeks that left Microsoft for the first time without a division in charge of Windows, or like with Windows in its mandate. And he just basically summarized the failures of the Steve Ballmer era and the whole idea that Windows should be the privileged place for Microsoft's software to run, and therefore hardware should be built to privilege Windows, and the whole Surface line was created and all of that.
Right.
Not to mention the acquisition of Nokia and the attempt to do Windows Phone like so far too late. It doesn't seem like Satya Nadella is that interested in the Surface. He's more interested in empowering these other more cloud-based divisions to build software targeting everything. And so I was sitting there thinking about that, like, wow, like this is an incredibly momentous pivot in Microsoft's history. And then I thought about it for two more seconds and realized that they're the only major company that I have absolutely no interaction with.
Yeah, yes, it's true.
Maybe it's not that big of a deal after all. Like, if you're talking about really like Google, Amazon, Apple, companies that people are spending their entire day with in terms of real products that are in our lives, the companies that are selling devices to people are clearly just trying to find as many ways in as they possibly can, and they'll take what they can get. So it is a different world than the one where you bought a thing because you thought it was going to be the next big thing, and then it wasn't, and now your Windows Phone is useless.
Now you're stuck with a Zune.
Right. You know, we all dream about the time when they will all play nice again. I feel actually much better about that than I have in the past. I mean, I still get a pretty great Amazon experience on iOS. I still get a really great Google experience on iOS.
Totally.
And I wouldn't want any more of a Google experience than the one that I have. The idea of using Amazon's interfaces for everything fills me with fear. So I think we've gotten to that point where, like, you can be an Apple device user and still have the services of all of these companies, and those companies will be perfectly happy to serve you instead of making you buy their crappy thing. But that's still a level removed from that what do you need to do question, because it assumes a starting point. And, like, maybe it's even silly to question whether we should take for granted the fact that, like, you should have digital devices that connect to the internet. And that will help you do what you do. Like, it's increasingly impossible not to have that. It's got to be assumed now that this is going to be part of one's life. It's going to be one of the starting points to the answer to the question of what do you need to do and how are you going to do it? There are so many bad answers by quick fixes with the wrong incentives and the wrong investments. And I don't think it seems like a stretch anymore to go from how am I going to check my email or watch my March Madness to worrying about it at this level. Like, maybe worrying is just adding anxiety to what should be a creative problem-solving session, but it's all implicated, because if you're incentivized to just do the easiest possible thing, like, look where we end up.
I have no response to that.
I'm still tearing up the floorboards. I'm still sure there's a better way. There's a more comfortable posture for me than what I've gotten so used to. And there is a sense in which the individual has never been more empowered to make their own solutions to these questions in personalizable ways, using things that companies with different incentives from their users are providing to them. And it's still worth it to me, because there's such a reward to getting it working. And even if it's going to break again soon, getting it working gives me so much more perspective on life and on reality than I would have if I threw my hands up and just accepted the lowest common denominator or ran away and lived in the woods. I think that the potential is not only still there, the potential that was seen at the beginning of the digital age to, like, empower every person, I don't think it's merely still ahead of us. I think that it's coming true. Mm. And the fact that the challenges are getting harder and the threats are getting more serious, that is probably to be expected when you add complexity to the world.
Right.
And the thing that needs to come along with that, the thing that needs to outpace that increasing complexity and challenge, is our own sense of responsibility to answer the question of how we're going to do what we need to do, because what we need to do is expanding. When somebody asks, like, what phone should I buy? There's a conversation to be had about what they want to do with their phone. That's more of a conversation than they may be trying to have. They may be trying to watch their shows, but they are also making values choices. And, you know, as people who think about technology in terms of its values, like, who better than us to have that conversation, because the companies that are selling them something are not going to have that conversation as honestly as we are.
I'm very optimistic about the future of technology in a way that I'm not optimistic about the future of, like, our social platforms and different things like that. And part of why I feel confused and sad sometimes is just because I want to get to the future faster.
Yeah.
And that's okay that I'm so excited about the future that I wish it was here today, as opposed to being so just confused about what the future is looking like that I have no idea what to do or how to move forward. And we talked a little bit about this when we talked about the Apple Watch at length. But one of the reasons that I'm so happy with Apple and why I continue to choose Apple is not just because their stuff is good, but it's because I feel like their values are good. Mm-hmm. And why I end up steering people towards Apple is because I know that they are looking for something that has good values, and I want to steer them to something with good values. And it's interesting to me, in the wake of how much we're upset with Facebook at how constantly I hear jokes made about how the echoes are listening in. Mm-hmm. And I've never once heard that about the HomePod, and I don't think I will anytime soon, because that speaks to the difference of values between Amazon and Apple within the public conscious. And I don't know if a reckoning is coming for Amazon in that way. Maybe not. Maybe they'll miss that, or miss it for a long while until things get a bit more controlled. But at the same time, yeah, like, I am excited about the fact that these questions that we're considering are questions that other people are considering. And when I think about reducing friction down, I don't necessarily think that in 2 years all friction will be gone. But I do know that as things pop up, other things get much better. Just like I have a memory of reading a comic book sideways on my laptop, I have a memory of downloading some weird third-party app on my iPhone, my first iPhone, and side-loading in an ebook in a way that wasn't intended to be loaded in, and being so happy with that process. So the fact that I have my Kindle and my iBook library on my phone at all times with hundreds of books and highlights saved and all of that stuff is a much less friction-filled experience than it used to be. So things are definitely getting better. They're just getting better while also showing me how much better they could be.
Well, and another way of looking at that same thing is to realize that maybe it's happening in fits and starts, but the user experience, capital U, capital E, like the experience of being a user of digital technologies, is getting filled out. Like, the fact that we have so many options to recommend people is proof that many of the problems are of user experience as a starting point are getting solved. So the fact that now we're able to assess these tools and options in terms of their values, instead of just in terms of their value in a capitalist sense, like in terms of what they represent and what world they will cause us to live in, and not just in terms of what brands will be plastered all over the walls and bus stops and billboards of the world, but like what structure the society that runs on these technologies will have. That's a sign that it's working, that the technological revolution is working in the sense that, like, the industrial revolution worked. Or it's not just that the technology is literally working better, it's that technology is working to construct a future at all, because we're able to now think of that future in terms of what its values will be. And that makes the choices much more significant. So it makes our recommendations more consequential than they might have been in 2012. Now we know that talking people into joining some social network like I was doing every day could lead them to... I'm getting dark again. The point is, like, the fact that it's now possible to have a public conversation about the values of technology can only be construed as a good sign.
Yeah.
Because it means we're getting close to a point where the leverage of the individual and of the family group and of the, you know, the democratic populace, which has been increased dramatically at an individual level by network technologies, that leverage is now going to be brought to bear on what we get out of this.